Let's generate our motivation. And recall that whoever we are now, we haven't always been this person. That in all of samsara, we've been born in so many different forms, had so many different experiences. And in many of those different forms we've been born into, we had parents. We were born from a mother and a father. And so reflect on the kindness that we've received from our parents, just in having us, just in making sure that we were taken care of so that we were able to grow up to become adults. Of course, there's probably many other kindnesses as well, and some of those may have been shown us by other caregivers or relatives or family friends. But there's something special about somebody giving us this body, which is the basis of our precious human life and the basis of, because we have a precious human life, of being able to meet the Dharma and practice the Dharma. Then we think that in so many of these other lives, other people were our mothers then and were similarly kind to us. So that in beginningless samsara, when we look around, everybody has in one rebirth or another been our mother, our father, whoever it is who took care of us, who raised us, who educated us, who fed us. And so to really feel that kindness that we've received from everybody in one previous lifetime or another, when we really think deeply about it and open our eyes to the kindness we've received, then automatically there's the desire to repay that kindness. And the best way to repay kindness is to be able to help people progress on the path so that they can be freed of cyclic existence. And to be able to do that wisely, we have to progress along the path ourselves. And becoming a Buddha makes us most qualified to be able to guide others, to repay their kindness in a way that it's difficult for ordinary beings to repay kindness. And so let's generate the bodhicitta motivation. So this meditation of remembering the kindness of other sentient beings when they were our parents, it's one that requires some feeling for rebirth. Yeah. And it's one that requires an open mind to really see other beings' kindness. Yeah. Instead of getting stuck in our stories. So it's interesting, you know, in Buddhism, when we talk about rebirth, and here it is, you know, in this bodhicitta meditation, yeah, about having many different rebirths and other sentient beings having been our parents. And one of the things that makes it so difficult for us to think about rebirth is that we are so stuck in our present identity of being who we are right now, that it's hard to imagine being anybody else. Even imagining being a baby is hard for us. Yeah, because we have a feeling, oh yeah, I imagine that I'm a baby, but I have the same mind I do with the same cognitive abilities and language, and I can talk to myself and explain what's happening and so on. Of course not, you know. It's hard for us to imagine being old or even being senile. Yeah, because that's like another person. And so often, you know, in Buddhism, if we look, so many of our meditations are asking us to imagine not being who we are now. Yeah, to realize who we are now is just a karmic bubble. Yeah, it's not a solid personal identity. And so similarly, in this meditation, we start thinking that other living beings have been our mother. And this one really throws us off. Yeah. You mean, all these other people have really been my mother? You mean that turkey out there in that garden was once my mother? Do you think, you know, that spider that I took outside today was once my mother and was kind to me? Yeah, Mitch McConnell was once my mother? Oh, goodness, what kind of mother was he? Yeah, the no mother, no. But, you know, to really think, you know, these people have not always been who they are. Yeah, Mitch McConnell was once our kind mother. Okay, so was that turkey. So was whoever it was that you can't stand today. Yeah, it rotates day to day who you can't stand, you know. And to think, you know, that our relationships have all been very different from one life to the next. We haven't always been who we are. They haven't always been who they are. You know? And so this gives room for us to really see that how we relate to other sentient beings, there's so much flexibility, so much change in it. Okay? And it really is very helpful not to make relationships too solid. Okay? And similarly, you know, when we have to, in this meditation, think about the kindness of our mother, you know, then some people, you know, it's hard for them to go to kindness. It's instantly, well, but she didn't do that, and she didn't do this, and my father did that and didn't do that, and blah, blah, blah. And a litany of, you know, everything we feel went wrong in our childhood. And yet this meditation is about seeing the kindness. So we're asked to see the kindness, and our mind responds with, this is everything that was wrong. Isn't that interesting? Yeah? Did you have that reaction when you first heard this meditation about the kindness of the mother? Yeah? Oh, yeah, that's very nice to say, but... Yeah? And I found that it's extremely important to be able to look at and really see for what it is, the kindness of our parents. Yes, that other stuff may have happened, but it's not happening now. And that's not the essential point of the relationship with our parents. The essential point is that they gave us life. And they took care of us. And if because of their own karma and their own incapacities, they couldn't take care of us, they found somebody else who could. Yeah. And I think that's really important to think about. Yeah. Even, you know, I mean, you read sometimes about people finding babies abandoned in subway stations or in the forest or wherever. Still, even if we were that kind of baby, you know, that happened to us as a baby. Like, I remember there was one person, it was Christmas time, and there was the manger scene in some church, and somebody came and put their baby there, you know. But look, that mother, you know, she couldn't take care of her baby, but she put the baby somewhere where somebody would find it and take care of it. Yeah. And so to really, you know, get it through our thick skulls, as my own mother would say, you know, it's another saying from my book of sayings from my mother. Your thick skull, get it through your thick skull. You know, that they've been kind to us, and that had they not been kind to us, we would not be alive today. Absolutely not, because there's no way when we were infants that we could take care of ourselves. Absolutely no way. Yeah, we couldn't feed ourselves. We couldn't even roll over. We couldn't put a blanket on if we were cold. We couldn't do anything as infants. Yeah. And so just the fact that we're alive today, it, you know, indicates the amazing kindness of other living beings. Yeah. And I think it's very, very important for us to open our heart and be able to take that in. Yeah. And not say yes, but. Okay. Put the buts in the garbage. They aren't happening now. Okay. Look at the benefit that we received. You know, it's really rather amazing when you think about it. And then when you think, especially that we haven't always been human beings. We've been dogs. We've been cockroaches. We've been, you know, pretas. Yeah, we've been all sorts of other living beings. And in many of those life forms, we've had parents who've taken care of us. Yeah, when we hear that story about the mother preta, you know why we make preta offerings every day after lunch? Because one mother preta had 500 children and she couldn't feed them. And so she was stealing human babies to feed her 500 children. And the Buddha said, what are you doing? And she explained her situation. And he said, don't worry, my disciples will offer you food every day after lunch. Yeah. But look at the, you know, what that mother preta was doing was horrible, killing other beings. But look how much she loved her children. Yeah. And so, you know, she stopped killing other, you know, the human beings. And the Buddha, the Sangha, gave her food to give to her children. But to think, you know, how much kindness we've received, and really let that into our heart, so that very naturally the wish to repay kindness comes about. Yeah. And whenever we hit one of those rough spots where our mind goes, yes, but, yeah, come back just to the basic fact, yeah, that we have this opportunity to practice the Dharma because somebody gave us this body. Yeah, that's the bottom line in the whole thing. Yeah. And so to really be thankful to them for that. And then to know, you know, the best way to repay kindness is by being able to help people learn the Dharma and practice the Dharma. And so, of course, to do that, we have to learn the Dharma and practice the Dharma ourselves. Okay? So, you know, then we have some responsibility. So, you know, when we do the five contemplations before lunch, the fifth contemplation, yeah, let's see if I can, I can never remember things when I have to recite them. I contemplate the aim of Buddhahood. Consuming this food in order to accomplish that, yeah? Okay. So whenever, you know, when I say that, that phrase is like, I have a responsibility. Yeah, I've received this through due to the kindness of others. I have a responsibility. Yeah, and I don't see a responsibility like that as a burden. I think I see that as a responsibility as a privilege. You know, His Holiness always talks about privileges and responsibilities. But, you know, when you think about it, the responsibility to practice the Dharma, to repay the kindness of others, is actually a privilege to be able to practice the Dharma, isn't it? You know, we're privileged to be able to practice the Dharma. But we have a responsibility. Because we have the circumstance due to the kindness of others. Yeah? So we shouldn't feel kind of inflated like, well, I have a precious human life, and so I'm special because I get to practice the Dharma. You know, if we have that kind of attitude, then we've missed the boat. Okay. So, you know, I was writing what I'm working on now. I was doing this meditation today. And I find that, you know, I mean, it's been 40-something years working with this meditation. And just to see how the mind has progressed. Yeah. And I must say that this meditation, I mean, I had the same reaction that many of you did the first time I heard of it. Was like, what? You know? Or as you would say, double what? And but I found that really sticking with that meditation, it really helped me clear up so much stuff, mental stuff that I had accumulated about my parents. Yeah, it helped me let go of so much stuff, even though it was a tough meditation. Okay. You know, sometimes you just think about what your parents did their whole lives to support their kids. Yeah, would you live your life the way your parents lived their life in order to support their kids? Would you want to do that? I wouldn't, you know? And yet they happily lived their lives, or unhappily, but they did it, you know, because they cared about us. Yeah. Really kind of amazing when you think about it. Huh? And we all would get up in the middle of the night screaming, another phrase from my mother, screaming bloody murder. Did your mother say that too? Okay. No? Oh, you, okay. 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 Blue murder.
I don't know what it means.
I don't either. No, it's like, you kids are screaming bloody murder in the middle of the night. And it's like, well, I was just a baby and I was hungry, you know. But they got up in the middle of the night, especially mom, to feed us for years. Yeah, for years. Would you get up in the middle of the night to feed somebody? Like, go to the refrigerator yourself, you know? Who do you think I am, your mother? Yeah? But you really, you know, you think about it and how they did that. Change the diapers and, yeah, when I was a baby, they didn't have throwaway diapers, yeah? So our mothers had to wash our diapers. Yeah? They couldn't just throw it away, you know? They had to wash the diapers. I heard somewhere that, you know, mothers don't see that even their baby's poo is dirty. And I asked one mother about this, you know, and she said, it's true. She said, it's true. Your child's poo, you don't see as dirty. Wow, that shocked me. Yeah. But, you know, I think this is a very good way of really opening ourselves up to see things in a different way. Yeah. And to see that we wouldn't be who we are now with the abilities that we have now if it weren't for other people. Yeah, that we're not some kind of independent, self-made person. Yeah, who picked ourselves up with our baby booties. Yeah, we aren't that kind of person, are we? Okay, so we're on the part about view. Oh, that's where we left off? Really? Okay. Okay, so page 76. Speaking of the various Buddhist traditions and teachings can only be done in a general way. As we know, people don't always fit into neat categories with well-defined borders. Ah, shucks. But we want to put people into neat categories with well-defined borders. Yeah? So we know who they are. But it doesn't work like that. As in Buddhism, one teacher, many traditions, we will speak of two principal Buddhist traditions according to the language they came to be written in, the Pali and Sanskrit traditions. The Buddha himself taught in some form of Prakrit, a group of languages spoken in India by the common people of his time. After his parinirvana, the discourses were collated into groups and passed on orally for several centuries. So there were specific groups of monks, and I imagine nuns too, who would memorize different sutras, and they were responsible for memorizing those sutras, teaching them to their students, and keeping that sutra alive in verbal form You know, they didn't have Xerox machines, they didn't have computers, they didn't have typewriters. Yeah, there was some form of writing, you know, but it was slow, and so everything was passed down orally, which is quite a feat. So the people who memorized were called Banakas or Banakas. And that's where the term Bhante comes from. In the Theravada tradition, what you call the elder monks is Bhante, you know, and it comes from that term, Banaka. The earliest written text we have date from around the 1st century BCE. And the texts were first written down, His Holiness's theory, okay, is that even at the time of the Buddha, there were people who wrote down the texts, the Mahayana teachings, but didn't, promulgate them profusely in society because they weren't suitable for the people of that time. But he thinks that somebody must have written down something, you know, so because he really thinks that the Mahayana Sutras were spoken by the Buddha at the time during the Buddha's life, although he says they weren't necessarily spoken always to human audiences, because if you look at the Heart Sutra, you know, when it talks about the people who attended the teachings, and then you go to the place in Rajgir. The place where he taught the Heart Sutra is not bigger than this room, and yet there were, you know, how many thousands of, you know, monks and nuns, and there were yakshas and all sorts of beings and devas and bodhisattvas, and, you know, so His Holiness said, you know, the bodhisattvas were probably sitting in the air somewhere, yeah, a few human beings down on the ground. So that the Mahayana Sutras weren't always taught just to a human audience. Okay. And he thinks were probably written down, but kept very private. Yeah. But the story, as we hear it from the Theravada tradition, is that it was passed down orally. And then in the 1st century BCE, there was a famine, and so many people starved, and they became very concerned that, you know, if many monks died, then the lineages of monks who could recite these sutras would die, and the lineages would be lost. So the 1st century BCE is when they started writing things down in Sri Lanka. And that's why they did. Okay, and both Pali and Sanskrit emerged as primary languages for transmitting the words of the Buddha. So both Pali and Sanskrit were, it seems, there's so many different opinions on this, but it seems like both of them were the languages of the intelligentsia. Okay, so, so you wanted to write things down in the language of the intelligentsia. I don't know Prakrit if, you know, it had written forms or what. The Sanskrit tradition, as we describe it here, also includes texts in ancient Central Asian languages such as Gandhari. So, there were other scripts besides Sanskrit and other languages that at least the Sanskrit tradition was written in. So Gandhari, that was Pakistan, Afghanistan, Central Asia. That whole area was once a flourishing Buddhist community, you know, just completely flourishing because it was part of the lower Silk Road. Yeah. So, and now they've been finding many items. And some texts, some years ago, they found a whole slew of texts that they didn't know about before in that area of Asia. And In UW is where Richard Solomon is and Colette Cox, and they are great scholars of these ancient, Gandhari and Brahmini texts. And our friend Venerable Tianqing, yeah, she was a graduate student at UW, and she helped, with, they would translate this. So I got to go with her one afternoon when they were translating, and it was so inspiring, because, they had these fragments of texts that had been photographed. Because they're so flimsy, they would just fall apart if you touch them nowadays, basically. So they would have them photographed and they would shine them up on the wall. And then they would try and, it was like a mystery story, figure out what it was saying. And what made it difficult is you wouldn't have the whole page. Part here would be missing, it was torn here, this part was faded out. But for me, just to sit there and think, this stuff was written almost 2,000 years ago. Yeah, somebody wrote this down 2,000 years ago. Did that person have any idea that people 2,000 years later would be looking at what they wrote down, in a university and try and figure out what it is? Yeah. So somehow the experience was very moving for me to see how they were, really trying to understand what these sutras said. Okay. And Richard Solomon has written a book, a few books about it. And I think one of them just came out last year, and then some other ones have come out before. Okay. But before exploring the historical development of these traditions, it is helpful to be acquainted with the spiritual vehicles that they teach. Okay. So when we say, this will come here, but when we say jnana is usually translated as vehicle, like in Mahayana, okay? Jnana is actually synonymous with path. And path refers to a consciousness. So even though we talk about, the great vehicle, or we're following the path as if the path is, here it is and you follow it. We talk like that, as if the path is a path and the vehicle were a vehicle. But it's actually, both of them are consciousnesses. Yeah. And so we talk about a path consciousness. So that's one that somebody who has attained a path has. Okay. So we talk about, well, we're on the path. Okay. Actually, we haven't actualized a path yet. And we haven't really, and we say, I'm a Mahayana practitioner. Actually, we haven't even entered the Mahayana yet. Okay? So, because if we talk about the Mahayana, or we talk about the fundamental vehicle, there's five paths, of which it is composed. Yeah. To enter the first path of the fundamental vehicle, you have to have the realization, like it says in three principal aspects of the path, of the wish for liberation day and night. Okay? Remember chanting that? Yeah, you have to have that to enter the fundamental vehicle path, the lowest path of the whole fundamental vehicle. To enter the Mahayana, you have to have spontaneous bodhicitta whenever you see some sentient beings. So that frog out there, okay, when you see that frog and any other sentient being, if our response is, I want to get enlightened for their benefit, then we've entered the Mahayana vehicle. Okay. Every single sentient being, we can't leave one out. So the frog, you know, his parents, his siblings, his children, you know, chain migration, all of them can come in. Okay. We accept chain migration in Buddhism. Yeah. And, you know, and we don't leave anybody out. So you can see that's just to enter those two paths. Mm-hmm. So I don't know about you. I haven't entered either of them. Okay. But the path, when we say the path, it means a consciousness with, you know, starting with those kind of realizations and then developing the realizations of emptiness and so on and so forth. Okay. So vehicle and path are synonyms. Well, these terms are frequently used to refer to a progressive set of spiritual practices. They technically refer to exalted knowers. Okay, so these are wisdom consciousnesses that are conjoined with the uncontrived determination to be free from samsara. Okay, so some kind of wisdom consciousness that's conjoined with the uncontrived determination to be free from samsara. Okay, and now again, I don't know about you, but my determination to be free from samsara is contrived or fabricated. In other words, I have to think about it. Yeah, I have to think about, oh yeah, there's some disadvantages to cyclic existence. Oh, really? You know, my samsara is pretty good. I just need to tweak it a little bit and make it better. Well, no, that's not it. Actually, you know, there's no true happiness to be found in samsara. So I have to cultivate my renunciation. Okay. Yeah. So that's the difference between contrived and uncontrived, or sometimes they say fabricated and unfabricated. Okay. When our teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, lived in India, he turned the Dharma wheel. That is, he taught the Dharma. That's what it means, turn the Dharma wheel. And specifically, turn the Dharma wheel means that a Buddha taught the Dharma in a place and historical time when the teachings were not yet available publicly. Okay? So before the Buddha lived, yeah, you might have lived on this planet. No, there were no such things as precious human lives then, because it was, you know, the Buddha had not come, the teachings weren't available, there was no Sangha. Okay. So turn the wheel, the Dharma wheel means to set all of that in motion. Okay. The Buddha turned the Dharma wheel by giving teachings for the beings of the three vehicles: the Shravaka, solitary realizer, or Pratyekabuddha, and Bodhisattva vehicles. These are called vehicles, or jnana, because they convey their respective practitioners to distinct spiritual attainments. Okay? According to the Sanskrit tradition, the three vehicles are differentiated in terms of the motivation to attain a specific goal. That's one thing that differentiates them. Their principal meditation object, the accumulation of merit and length of time necessary to attain those goals. Yeah. So that's how the Shravaka, solitary realizer, and Bodhisattva vehicles are differentiated. Yeah. Now, somebody may say, well, what about the Hinayana? Remember, I told you that term is banished. Okay, we don't use it. His Holiness, it's a very derogatory term. Nobody self-identifies as a Hinayanist. So it's for somebody who is seeking their own personal liberation from samsara. it's better to say they follow the Sharipaka vehicle or Pratyeka vehicle or solitary realizer Buddha vehicle, or just to say they follow the fundamental vehicle. Okay. And the reason is holiness calls those two vehicles fundamental is because to practice Mahayana or Vajrayana, we have to do it on the foundation of the common practices shared with the Shravakas. Okay. Each vehicle leads to its own awakening. So even though we usually say enlightenment or awakening, and it use it to refer to Buddhahood, actually, there's in the text, you speak of three kinds of awakening. Okay, the solitary realizer awakening, Shravaka awakening, solitary realizer awakening, and then Buddhahood. Okay, now here we're using the term Shravaka. My editor insisted that we use that. I wanted to use the term hearer. Other times people use the term listener. Okay, but now I'm actually completely okay with using the term Shravaka. Bhikkhu Bodhi explained to me that in ancient India, the term Shravaka just meant disciple. So all the various different teachers who taught in ancient India all their own philosophies, they all had Shravakas. They all had disciples. Yeah. So the Buddha, in many cases, he took terms that were in common parlance in his day, brought them into Buddhism, gave them a different meaning. And so this is what happened with the word Shravaka. Okay. So the Tibetans, when they explain why it's called hearer or listener, is they say, well, because these people heard the teachings from the Buddha, and then they taught them and made other people hear the teachings. So that's why they're called hearers. Okay. But it's interesting. I mean, and that's a gloss of the Tibetan word, how they translated Shravakas. And actually, Shravaka, it the same thing is in Shravasti. The Shra is the same. Yeah, because the Tibetan name for Shravasti is, what is it? Isn't it Nyenyul? Something like that. So it's like, yeah, the place of hearing. The place of hearing. Or Nen, not Yul. Nen. Yeah. Yeah, so that's, I think, how the Tibetans translate Shravasti.
What is the difference between the enlightenment of solitary realizer and enlightenment of a Shravaka? I didn't know there was a difference.
Yeah, they both attain arhatship. A Shravaka a solitary realizer has to practice much longer to attain their awakening than a Shravaka does.
They have different paths, but the same goal.
They have the same goal. The hearers in the Shravakas meditate primarily on the four truths. The solitary realizers meditate primarily on the 12 links. Okay, so they have different meditation objects. The amount of time they need to accumulate merit is different. The solitary realizers, there's different kinds of them, but the rhinoceros-like solitary realizers in their last life before they become a Buddha are born in a time when no Buddha has descended. And they teach the Dharma through hand gestures. Yeah. They're called Pratyeka Buddhas. Yeah, they aren't Buddhas, but they attain, you know, they attain the solitary realizer awakening. Okay. I don't know why they're called Pratyeka Buddhas, you know, but But probably for the same reason that they attain awakening, and there's different kinds of awakening.
Mm-hmm. I've said this, but the dictionary has Shravasti, the Tibetan is M-N-Y-A-N, and then the last second word is Y-O-D.
Yeah, Nyanyo.
Is that what you said?
Yeah, the M is silent.
And then the second is Y-O-D.
Y-O-D. Yeah, Nenya.
Yeah. I don't know the pronunciation.
Yeah. Yeah, the Tibetan has all sorts of silent letters. Yeah, so it's very difficult to learn to spell Tibetan.
If the Pratyekya Buddhas have to spend so much more time accumulating merit, is the quality of their nirvana different?
You know, we used to ask that same question too, and it seems like it's the same type of nirvana, but they just had different aspirations and different wishes about how they wanted to attain nirvana, you know, because nirvana is nirvana. You've eliminated all the afflictive obscurations. And so there aren't any solitary realizers now, because in our world, the Buddha has descended. So at least these rhinoceros ones aren't around. So often, you know, in the book, I just use Shravaka to refer to both of them, the Shravakas and the solitary realizers. Okay, both the... Yeah, each vehicle leads to its own awakening. Both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions contain teachings on all three vehicles, although the Pali tradition places more emphasis on the Shravaka vehicle and the Sanskrit tradition on the Bodhisattva vehicle. So this is one misunderstanding that many people have, is they think, you know, oh, these... Because sometimes instead of saying Pali and Sanskrit vehicles, they say the southern tradition and the northern tradition. Or they say Theravada and Mahayana. And it all gets quite confusing because we have all these stereotypes. Okay. And so the stereotype of the, well, people say, well, Pali, you know, they just practice the Shravaka vehicle. They don't generate great compassion. They don't have bodhicitta. They just work for they're selfish. Yeah. They're selfish. They just work for their own awakening. Yeah. So don't be one. Okay. That's kind of the essence of the message that is taught. Depending on which sutras, the Lotus Sutra is very intense about this whole thing. Other sutras are milder about it.
Spit on it.
It's a chance. Yeah. Oh, spit on it, right. Yeah. Okay. So, where was I? Yeah, I get distracted when people call out things. Okay. Oh, yeah. So one of the standard stereotypes is, okay, you know, those people, they're Theravada. You know, they just go for arhat ship. They don't know anything about, you know, the Mahayana. They don't know anything about love and compassion and bodhicitta. Okay. So I remember... many years ago, this was like 93 or 94, and His Holiness was teaching in Arizona, and he was teaching during the day, and then in the evening, there was some Western teachers teaching. So Sharon Salzberg gave a talk about metta, you know, in the evening talk. Were you there? Yeah. And so I have one of my dear Dharma friends, long-term Dharma friends, good practitioner, excellent scholar. He came away from that talk and said to me, oh my goodness, they talk about love. I didn't know that. You know, he was completely shocked, you know, about her talk about metta, you know. And I mean, I knew that, you know, I had lived in Singapore by that time. And so my little, you know, Tibetan bubble had been broken and I was exposed to all these other things by then. But but this is a standard stereotype, you know, and it's completely wrong. And actually, I mean, what we call the Theravada, the present-day Theravada, they do have a bodhisattva vehicle because the Buddha was once a bodhisattva. Yeah, and he had to practice the bodhisattva vehicle to become a Buddha. Okay, and so there's this beautiful text written in the 6th century by Dharmapala, who was an Indian, and it talks about the bodhisattva vehicle in the Pali tradition, yeah, and how the Buddha generated bodhicitta, and they have 10 paramis, or 10 paramitas. Many of them overlap in name with the 10 in the Sanskrit tradition, but even the ones that don't have the same names, the meanings are found from both traditions in the other tradition. Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's really inspiring to read this, you know, especially the, you know, the story of how the Buddha generated bodhicitta and so on. Yeah, so this is just, you know, yes, they have a bodhisattva vehicle. And I was very surprised when I went to Thailand, yeah, that the place I was staying, I may have told you this before, but the master in the place where I was staying, Achananan, yeah, he had been to Potosan, Chenrezig's island, in China, and they had a picture of him, you know, kneeling and bowing to Chenrezig. And there's in the photograph, there's this light coming from the statue going into the master. Yeah. And he was going to build in his Theravada monastery in Thailand a small temple for Chenrezig. And I was going to Dharamsala right after that. So he gave me these plates of copper to have His Holiness write something on, and then to bring them back, because I was coming back through Thailand, give them to him, and then when they made the statues, they would melt those copper plates in when they made the bronze to make the statue. And he had incredible faith in Chenrezig and Kuan Yin. Yeah, quite amazing. Okay. And they told me that there were some monks in Thailand that they considered to be emanations of Maitreya. Okay. So, you know, they... when I mentioned, because our tradition talks about 1,000 Buddhas of the fortunate eon, Bhikkhu Bodhi didn't seem familiar with that term. But, you know, yes, in our particular eon, there's many Buddhas, and Shakyamuni Buddha is the fourth, and Maitreya is the next Buddha. The difference is that in Theravada, they say, I'm getting way off track, but anyway, they say that the Buddha is also an arhat, and then actually in our prayers too, you know, to the teacher transcendent destroyer, foe destroyer is the English equivalent for arhat. Okay, so the Buddha is an arhat. The people who finish the Shravaka vehicle are also arhats. And they say that the difference is that the Buddha appeared in a time when the Dharma was not propagated, and he propagated the Dharma. Okay, so that's one way in which the Buddha was distinguished from the arhats, but they say that their realization, their enlightenment is the same, but the Buddha had kind of special compassion, and he taught the Dharma, and, you know, not everybody's going to become a Buddha, because Buddhas are only the wheel-turning Buddhas who teach the Dharma in these dark eras, yeah. And so everybody else becomes arhats, but in their mind, you know, the difference between an arhat and a Buddha is not this huge difference that it is in the Mahayana. Yeah. And it was very interesting. Those of you, when we were at the monastic gathering this last October in one of our first sessions, there was a huge discussion about the difference between an arhat and a Buddha. And Venerable Sangha Khadra was talking about that. And, you know, she was up on the panel. And oh boy, some of our Theravada friends were not very pleased when they heard about how the Mahayana speaks of arhats. And they were saying, but, you know, Buddhas are also arhats. So this is the kind of thing, you know, where you have to, you know, be very delicate and think about who you say what, no, what you say to who, okay? You know, because we don't want to offend anybody else, okay? And, oh, and when we had a breakout group, you know, the Migrate breakout group, they wanted to talk about this a little bit more. So I described how, you know, according to the Mahayana, that the Shravakas become arhats, and they're in their peaceful samadhi on the ultimate nature of reality, and then the Buddha wakes them up and tells them they need to generate bodhicitta and start all over on the bodhisattva path. Woo! Were any of you there in that breakout discussion group? Woo! They were not pleased when they heard that. The Buddha had to wake up arhats? Are you kidding? Because the arhats are, you know, who they revere the most and who they want to become. You know, like the arhats are sleeping and the Buddha had to wake them up. You know, they were really quite offended. So, yeah, so I'm just warning you next time, if you happen to be in that kind of, you know, situation, don't repeat exactly what the Tibetan lamas tell you, you know, because it's not going to turn out well in terms of creating harmony. Yeah. So, but one thing the Tibetan lamas do tell us is don't ever criticize the arhats, because we have nothing near the realization of the arhats. So there's nothing we should be critical of them for, because they're much superior than we are in terms of our realizations. Yeah. Yeah?
Yeah, so now I'm getting a bit confused with mm-hmm. the presentation of the tenets mm-hmm. as is given in the Tibetan system. The lower tenets accept the three vehicles, and they accept that there are different fruits. So the fruit of the mm-hmm. lower vehicle, of the Sravaka and the mm-hmm.
yeah.
Pratyeka vehicles is the arhatship, mm-hmm. and that the fruit of a bodhisattva vehicle is Buddhahood.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's differences in attainment. It's not just being an arhat, he also has omniscience.
Mm-hmm.
So would you yeah. say that in modern day Theravada tradition,
there's
they
different
claim
views
different?
Of seeing the Buddha. They have different views. The Theravada and the Mahayana have different views of who the Buddha is and what the qualities of a Buddha are. Yeah.
So is the presentation of these tenets where they say that the lower mm-hmm. systems accept that the fruit of bodhisattva vehicle mm-hmm. is an omniscient Buddha. Is that not
well,
correct?
All-knowing. They say the Buddha's all-knowing. Actually, the term is the same, but it's translated different because they want to give it different meanings. Because I'm not sure about the lower schools, but I know the Theravada, and you can find this in the Pali Canon, that they say that the Buddha knows everything, but he has to turn his mind to that object in order to know it. Whereas the Mahayana says it automatically just appears to his mind. Okay, so that's one difference, between how they see the Buddha. And, you know, our Theravada friends are, you know, often saying, you guys have made Buddha into a god. You know, Buddha was a human being who practiced the Dharma, who attained these results. And now you've made him into a god. He's in a pure land with this body of light and all these bodhisattvas. And, you know, he does all these magical things and he appears and disappears and all this kind of stuff. And they say, you've just exaggerated who the Buddha is. Okay. So it depends. Not everybody says that. They don't necessarily say it in that way. Okay. But that's, you know, there is a difference in how the traditions see the Buddha. Yeah. Well, no, they say the term arhat. I mean, everybody, both traditions say the Buddha is an arhat. Okay. Yeah. So it's curious. I've always wondered when the Mahayana says the Buddha is an arhat, what do they mean by arhat? Yeah. Because the Pali tradition view of an arhat, it's quite specific. Yeah. And they say, yes, the Buddha's an arhat. But the Mahayana makes a difference between a Buddha and an arhat. So why do they call the Buddha an arhat? There must be something left, historically, with the early schools and the evolution of how they develop prayers and so on. Because that verse that we chant, to the founder, teacher, transcendent destroyer, that verse is also in the Pali, almost exactly. So, that same verse must have started out in all 18 early schools. And then, was in the Mahayana also. But I wonder what the Mahayana, if they define arhat specially there. Not in the research I've done. They seem to define arhat the same way, even when they call Buddha an arhat. But then they also call him Bhagawan. Yeah, and that's different from in the Mahayana way from what an arhat is. Anyway, if you don't get any other point, you can get the point that names and categories are extremely confusing. Okay? And we haven't gotten into anything yet. Yeah, I tried to simplify it in this volume, but oh my goodness, when you get into all these different vehicles, and then you have Theravada, and you have Vajrayana, and you have Tantrayana, and you have things, and then you have Vipassana. And, in the West, people say there's three traditions, Vipassana, Zen, and Tibetan Buddhism, or Vajrayana. And so in the West, people equate Tibetan Buddhism with Vajrayana. That is incorrect. Yeah, they also have Vajrayana in Japan. And not all of Tibetan Buddhism is Vajrayana. That's why it's His Holiness's fundamental vehicle, because Vajrayana is a branch of the Mahayana, and you practice Mahayana on the basis of the fundamental vehicle. Yeah, but in the West, Vajrayana, Zen, Vipassana, Zen, and Vajrayana. It's like, first of all, Vipassana is a meditation technique that is found in every Buddhist tradition. So why do we call one Buddhist tradition in America Vipassana when, you know, the Zennies practice Vipassana, we practice Vipassana. Yeah. But now Vipassana has come to have just a certain meaning in America. And then Zen, yeah. So people don't even know that there's so many different Mahayana traditions. Yeah, in China, there's so many. There's Huayan, there's Pure Land, there's different kinds of Pure Land teaching. There's, what else is there? I can't remember all of them. Tentai, right. There's Tentai. There's a Madhyamaka school. There's a Chittamatra school. How they divide the schools in China is very different than how the Tibetans divide them. Yeah. They have a small tantric school in China. They have some what we would call fundamental vehicles, schools, a Vinaya school in China too. So it's... Yeah, you have to have a real flexible mind because the categories just, you know, you can't squeeze everybody into the categories you want. Yeah, so in the West, you know, saying Zen, yeah, or Chan, yeah, and they forget about all the other Mahayana schools. And they see Vajrayana as a whole different tradition, unrelated to the Shravaka vehicle, unrelated to Mahayana. But actually, Vajrayana is a type of Mahayana tradition. It's not separate from Mahayana, you know. And you practice both Mahayana and Vajrayana on the basis of the fundamental vehicle. So I remember at this one Western Buddhist teachers conference I attended many years ago, you know, and that's how they talked. And Gelug Rinpoche, who was alive at that time, he gave a talk there and he corrected it and explained how it should be spoken of. Nobody took it in. Nobody took it in. All the people after that, you know, or at least the non-Tibetan people. But even some of the Tibetan people, you know, say, we practice Vajrayana. You know, our whole practice is not Vajrayana.
Where does the term Sutrayana come in?
Oh, this is another term. Good. Yeah. Because we have Sutrayana, then we have Paramitayana. Okay, then we have Vajrayana. So Sutrayana, I can't remember if I have it in this book or not. It doesn't look like it. Yeah. Sutrayana is talking about the sutra vehicle. So the sutra vehicle is comprised of the fundamental vehicle teachings and the Mahayana teachings that are not tantra, that are the sutra-based Mahayana teachings. That's the Sutrayana. The Paramitayana, or perfection vehicle, is the part of the Sutrayana that talks about Mahayana scriptures, that is rooted in Mahayana scriptures. But Paramitayana does not include Vajrayana. So it's like if you had, okay, how would you draw this as a chart? You mean one way you could do it is Sutrayana and if you had some, you would have to have Sutrayana and Vajrayana because they're distinct. But under Sutrayana, you would have a fundamental vehicle, which would be the Shravaka vehicle and the solitary realizer vehicle. And you would also have the Paramitayana, the perfection vehicle, which is part of the Bodhisattva vehicle. But you couldn't write Bodhisattva vehicle there. You would have to write perfection vehicle because the Bodhisattva vehicle has two strands. One part is the perfection vehicle, and one part is, one part actually would include Sutrayana and the perfection vehicle and the Vajrayana. Are you confused? Good. Yeah. Yeah.
And is it
3P
or
4P? Yeah. It's just words. Yeah, quite confusing. Okay, shall we read something? Okay. So both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions contain teachings on all three vehicles. Okay, although the Pali places more emphasis on the Shravaka vehicle and the Sanskrit on the Bodhisattva vehicle. Okay, so, the Sanskrit tradition has the Mahayana teachings, the Vajrayana teachings, and within the Mahayana text, it also describes how to practice to become an arhat following the Shravaka vehicle and the Pratyekabuddha vehicle. Sometimes the Shravaka and Solitary Realizer vehicles are subsumed under the name Fundamental Vehicle. While both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions explain the Bodhisattva vehicle, in the Sanskrit tradition, it is called the Universal Vehicle, or Mahayana, and relies on sutras that were widely disseminated later. So they were disseminated later, but from the viewpoint of the Mahayana, they were not written or spoken later. Okay. The Bodhisattva vehicle, and the Tibetans don't tend to use the term Bodhisattva vehicle. They just use Mahayana. But when we're talking to our Theravada friends, they're not so fond of the word Mahayana, because Mahayana implies Hinayana. Okay, so... I'm trying to write this and not offend anybody. Difficult. Okay. While both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions explain the Bodhisattva vehicle, and the Sanskrit tradition is called the Universal Vehicle and relies on sutras that were widely disseminated later. The Bodhisattva vehicle is further divided into two according to method, the perfection vehicle and the tantric vehicle. These are both practiced on the basis of the fundamental vehicle, and the tantric vehicle is also practiced on the basis of the perfection vehicle. Or if you put the fundamental vehicle and the perfection vehicle together, you call that the sutra vehicle or sutrayana. The tantric vehicle can also be divided in different ways. One way is explained in an explanatory tantra, the Vajra Tent Tantra, which speaks of four tantric classes, action, performance, yoga, and highest yoga tantra. But the Nyingma don't divide the tantra. They have a whole different thing. They talk about nine vehicles. Okay. No, not all are tantra. They talk of nine vehicles. The first three are Shravaka, Pratyekabuddha, Bodhisattva. Then the next three are comparable to the three lower tantras. And then the last three, you have Adi, and the top one is Dzogchen. Okay, so they have a nine vehicle system. And the Nyingmas have a different canon because they have all these tantric texts that got destroyed before the new translation school came in. So the Nyingma and then the new translation schools don't have the same tantric texts. There's some overlap, of course, but not exactly the same tantric texts. Okay, so then you look at the chart. Okay. And so you see in this division, nowhere does it say the Vipassana tradition or the Zen tradition or Tibetan Buddhism. And His Holiness says that he feels very uncomfortable when people talk about Tibetan Buddhism, because then we should talk about Laotian Buddhism and Sri Lankan Buddhism and Thai Buddhism and Korean. And we do talk about Korean and Chinese and Japanese Buddhism, but then, you know, each of the Theravada countries, we should talk about it if they have their own Buddhism too. And in some ways they do, because I was present when, this is something that's really cool. Tartang Tulku, he's a Nyingma Lama in the Bay Area. He's a lay person now. But he sponsors the reading of the canon every year in Bodhgaya. So I happened to be there one year when they were doing it. And they did a huge Sangha Dana for all the Sangha that was there. And it was amazing. There was a whole procession to the tent where there was the Sangha Dana, and there was an elephant leading it and an elephant in the tent. And, you know, I mean, it was this traditional, the way Indians do things. Yeah, it was beautiful. It was really beautiful, you know, with all the flowers and offerings and things like that. Anyway, after the Sangha Dana, then people, because they sponsored this so that all the Theravada monks can read the Pali Canon. But they pretty much have the same Pali Canon. There's a few more texts, I think, in the Burmese version of it than in the others. One of them has a few more texts than the others. But the way they pronounce the Pali differs, and the way they chant differs. So under the Bodhi tree, they had a Thai section and a Sri Lankan section and a Burmese section and a Laotian section and a, what's the other one? Starts with a C. Cambodian section. Yeah, so that they could all recite the Pali Canon according to how they do it in their own countries. And I thought it was so beautiful that there's this Tibetan Lama who is sponsoring all of that. Yeah, I thought that was just so beautiful. Okay. Let's just finish this section. Nowadays, the vehicles of the Shravakas and Bodhisattvas are prominent. In their last lives, the solitary realizers appear in a time and place where no Buddha has turned the Dharma wheel. I think that's only a certain kind of solitary realizer, the rhinoceros kind. I think there's other kinds too. Since this is the case, when we speak of Shravakas, it will include solitary realizers unless there is a specific reason to delineate their practice separately, because now we don't have any solitary realizers, well, at least in our universe. While the teachings on the Bodhisattva vehicle in the Pali and Sanskrit traditions overlap in several ways, the name Mahayana refers to the Bodhisattva teachings and scriptures in the Sanskrit tradition.
So in the Mahayana, do they describe extra practices to become a wheel-turning Buddha as opposed to just a regular Buddha?
No, you know, because all the Buddhas have the same qualities according to Mahayana. And then, you know, the rest of the thousand for our eon, they're already predicted. But I guess you could go to another universe and become a wheel-turning Buddha. There's plenty of spaces, plenty of sentient. There is no shortage of sentient beings who need to hear the Dharma.
How does the language Gandhari relate to Prakrit? Are they unrelated or?
Gandhari is a separate language, and it has its own script. Mm. Yeah, I don't know much about Prakrit, if it has its own script. Yeah.
Venerable, I'm suffering from a bit of confusion.
I wonder why.
According to the New Oxford American Dictionary, Theravada is defined as the more conservative of the two major traditions of Buddhism, the other being Mahayana and a school of Hinayana Buddhism. Which seems a little bit problematic that it's defined that way in a major
dictionary. How are they defining Hinayana? What are they?
They're defining Theravada as the more conservative of the two Buddhist traditions.
Yeah, that's a stereotype.
The other being Mahayana and a school of Hinayana Buddhism.
And in school?
And a school of Hinayana Buddhism. And a Hindu
school. That's different than Theravada.
Yeah, it's like a sub-school.
Well, anyway, Oxford Dictionary.
But what would be the definition then of Theravada? That's not
okay. So here, Theravada. Then we got Theravada is the kind of Buddhism that is now practiced in Southeast Asia. That is, we would say, is emphasized by the Pali tradition, and we would say it's a fundamental vehicle tradition. Yeah. But when the word Theravada started being used, it wasn't one of the original 18 schools. Yeah. So it appeared later. And there's some report, what was it? Some scholar found the earliest report of Theravada was in South India, not even in Sri Lanka, where they found the term used. So, okay. Tara, it means tradition of the elders. Okay, and the Sanskrit term was Staviravada, which was one of the major categories of the 18. But the Theravada, even though it looks like it's a translation of into Pali of Staviravada, it was a term that appeared much later. Yeah, and then if you have the Americans, okay, then you have the Vipassana people. Yeah, who, that's a whole other ballgame. I don't know if Goenka G even says he's Buddhist. I'm not sure. I heard it. Anybody know? He teaches what he teaches is definitely Buddhist, but whether he self-identifies as a Buddhist, I'm not sure.
Who is he?
Huh?
Who are you?
Goenkaji. But that's what I mean. What he teaches is Buddhism, but I don't know if he self-identifies. Or it could be that the tradition maybe at one point didn't self-identify as a Buddhist, but now does. I'm not sure. We have to look it up, okay? Yeah, because, I mean, how people self-identify is a whole other ballgame, okay? Where was I before we got off on that? Was something about Vipassana. So the Vipassana people, they don't, even though what they practice is descendant from the Theravada tradition, yeah, because what they practice, there were the young Americans, my generation, who went to Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, and they really liked the the kind of Vipassana meditation that they practiced there. So they brought that back to America, but they didn't bring back the entire Theravada tradition because they didn't think all of the philosophy, you know, and the whole context, Buddhist context, was necessary for Americans. They just wanted the tradition to help people get in touch with themselves. So some Vipassana people may self-identify as Buddhists. I know years ago, I don't know how it is now, but I know years ago, They will self-identify as Buddhist, but they will not self-identify as Theravada. Okay, at least years ago, some of the Vipassana people would not say we are Theravada. Theravada is those monks over there who are conservative. That's where you get the conservative part. Okay, conservative, hierarchical, patriarchal. We're Vipassana people. We don't have that baggage. So they didn't self-identify as Theravada. Now we see that there's more closeness and harmony between some of between the Western Theravadas and the Vipassana people. Yeah. Like, for example, our last monastic gathering was at Spirit Rock. Yeah. And, you know, so that's pretty significant, I think. And recently they've been having more monastics speak at Theravada monastics speak at Spirit Rock, also at the Barry Institute for Buddhist Studies. So I think they're coming closer together now, the Vipassana and Theravada in the West. Yeah. But then you have the Vipassana, and you know, the latest rage is mindfulness. So I even got a request to do some teachings for a Tibetan group, and all the whole thing was about mindfulness. You know, I can't remember the different categories. You know, how you mindfulness of the defects of samsara, mindfulness of bodhicitta, mindfulness of everything was mindfulness. Okay, did you read that out? Okay. It was an invitation I received. So that was quite interesting. Yeah, so just words are like, you know, you dance with words and they twirl around and they're hard to pin down.
Mm-hmm. If anyone's really interested in exploring this, the Wisdom podcast, the Wisdom Publications podcast, has interviews with Joseph Goldstein and the whole crew, Sharon, everybody. They talk about their journey. It's really fascinating, interesting. So you know,
yeah, it's nice because they've interviewed people from many different traditions, and some of the I think the online news, you know. News things, Buddhist online news things. They do things from many traditions, and I don't know. It's hard to keep up with the whole thing.
When I was in Taiwan at the Triple Platform, I met a monk who was there, and he was from Bangladesh, and he is from a minority group there that had been Buddhists since
way back,
and he actually had moved to Sri Lanka to go to a Buddhist university, and then he was over in Taiwan studying in Taiwan, and he took the Bodhisattva precepts.
Yeah,
and he was considering burning his head, but he decided that might not be good for the people he would be around. But it was I did not know that there was a traditional group there that had been, you know, Buddhist since before the
way long time in Bangladesh.
And they're actually very marginalized, and they're on the area that's actually kind of near where what's the Muslim group that's fleeing the Rohingya. They're near where they're coming into Bangladesh.
Yeah, it stopped now, but years ago we would get several letters from monks in Bangladesh, you know, wanting to come and stay at our monastery. Yeah, and the reason was they wanted to get out of Bangladesh, you know, because the living conditions were horrible. And I don't know how, you know, they are marginalized in in Bangladesh. But, you know, of course, we know that they were contacting us because they wanted the visa, not because, you know, they really wanted to be a part of our monastery.
So are there other countries that have little groups that have been there traditionally for a long time?
Probably, you know, hidden way back up in the mountains and tribal areas. Yeah. 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 But he was from lower down, I think. This is, I'm forgetting, what's the name of the group? But they're in the mountains somewhere in a tribal area, the people you're thinking about. We also see, those are also the people we see who come to His Holiness's teachings in Asia, who are chanting and holding an alms bowl. They're essentially begging, and we don't know if they're real monks or not. Yeah. What's the area called? Chittagong, yeah. Yeah, Chittagong. That's the area. Yeah.
A question online. Is Buddhism the only way to liberate from cyclic existence, since Pacheco Buddhas liberate from cyclic existence without Buddhist teaching?
The Pacheco Buddhas follow the Buddhist teachings. It's just the rhinoceros Pacheco Buddhas, in the life in which they attain their enlightenment, they live in a world where the Buddha hasn't taught. But all their lives before that, where they were accumulating so much merit, they lived where the Buddha taught and studied the Dharma. Okay, so it's not that they were non-Buddhist and then one lifetime they became arhats, not like that.